guess I've been, I've been thinking about change. So I just want to talk about change a little bit. As with pretty much everything you've heard today, it's a team effort, both from the people listed there, but also sort of these thoughts are informed by conversations with Tom, with Pete, with Di, and with Tim, and with others. So if I get anything right, of course, it's thanks to them typically. So in thinking about change, I've been trying to kind of untangle some of the different components of change and to think a little bit about the way we think about change. So some meta thinking, if you like. And in terms of thinking about change, there's a couple of different components to try and understand. And these are we can call them benchmarks and thresholds. So benchmarks are basically what we consider to be normal. Now the world's variable, variation is normal. In a place like the Pilbara, we've heard about cyclones. Cyclones come along every year or so, they hammer the system, they reset it to some other state, and then it recovers. So that kind of variation is normal. It's natural. So what I want to unpick a little bit about are these concepts of what's normal, what's natural, what's acceptable. So in terms of thinking about what's natural, there probably aren't too many places in the world that haven't been influenced by humans at least a little bit. So there probably aren't too many places in the world that are completely natural, where the variation is completely natural. But there's lots of places in the world where we consider it to be more or less normal. So we intuitively, without thinking, we accept, yeah, humans have an impact on the planet, and so that's normal. But then there's this, wrapping into that, there's this concept of what's acceptable. So there's some elements of change that we're prepared to accept, some elements of change that we're not prepared to accept. And so this is wrapped up in these concepts about how do we go about measuring change, how we go about detecting change. And then how we do that also loops back around to what's acceptable. So think of abrupt change. We're pretty good at measuring abrupt change. We've got things like Backey designs, before or after control impact. We get a nice big change. That's unacceptable. But if that same change were to happen gradually over 10 years, there's a very good chance that we would find it acceptable. We might not think about it. It's the boiling frog effect. And then looped into that is this concept of thresholds. So once we get to a certain threshold where the system flips from one state to another, all of a sudden that's unacceptable. But by then it's too late. So just trying to think about all those concepts, and I guess the framework for my thinking is around using the marine parks and the KPIs as kind of hypotheses to go and test, but the thinking's kind of applicable to, you know, to fisheries management, to dredging management, to sort of implementation policy of all kinds. Illustrating the concepts, it's kind of useful to think about global temperature change. That's a plot. You can download the data, plot it up. That's just global temperature for the last 120 odd years. And what it shows is roughly in the 40s to 50s, there was a shift where temperature started climbing. It's spiky. Variation is normal. You get your cool years, you get your warm years, but these days the cool years are hotter than the warm years used to be. That's handy. But it's even more informative to look at that in the context of what history has used to tell us. So this is just the same kind of data that clever people have been able to put together, taking us back 400,000 years. So we can put the context of what we're experiencing in our lifetimes against what the Earth's experienced over many millennia, and we can start to look at what we might consider to be natural, what we might consider to be normal. And then when we think about what we might consider to be acceptable, we start thinking about these thresholds. So, for example, thinking about melting of the West Antarctic ice sheet. We don't know exactly what that tipping point is going to be, but at some point there's so much inertia in the system that even if we stop and reverse, that ice sheet's going to melt. So that's kind of a threshold that probably is going to be unacceptable to most people because it's going to cause sea level rise and various other kind of negative influences. So that's kind of an illustration of something that's probably in sort of public conversation at the moment. But what I've been looking at, these are sort of the marine park plans for the area that we're interested in as part of the PMCP. And they're really good documents to look at for lots of reasons, but not least of which they set out some nice clear statements about what the aims of these places are for and how we go about thinking about whether we're achieving those aims. So, for example, thinking about fish, which I'll show some data for. So they've got some aims couched in performance measures that we don't want to lose any abundance of fish inside the sanctuary zones as a result of human activity. So there's two concepts linked in there. One's about we don't want to lose anything, so we don't want any change, so we've got to think about how we go and measure that. And then there's cause consequence. So we don't want any change as a result of human activity. So if it's natural change, that's kind of okay, but if it's caused by some kind of human activity, that's kind of not okay, right? And then how are we going to measure that? Well, we're going to be monitoring, measuring abundant size compositions and wanting to make sure that inside those sanctuary zones that's going to be at natural levels. All right, so we've got some clear guidance from the marine park plans about what we want. So we go and start doing this, and back in 2007, Russ led a bunch of surveys, and we went to a few different places, and we did exactly that. We measured fish abundance. And here, I've just plotted up the biomass of lithrinids, lumped them together for convenience sake. And in terms of biomass estimation, that's just using how many there are and what size there are and turning them into a single measure of biomass. And so green zones, the sanctuary zones, the red zones, these sort of recreation zones where folk can go angling. In 2007, there was pretty much in all places that we went, there was a greater biomass of this group inside the sanctuary zones than in the other places that we went. So, okay, that's great. So I think it's kind of a feel-good tick-off, if you like, that as a snapshot, those sanctuary zones are doing what they're supposed to be, except that's just a snapshot, and snapshots don't tell us anything really about change. We've got a space for time kind of concept in there because we're comparing fished and ostensibly unfished areas, but that's not great. It's kind of a weak inference when we're thinking about change. So what we were keen to do, and we've been able to do now for 10 years, is just to go back and do the same thing over and over and over. So this is the same group of fish, but it's just taking one place, plotting up the data. So this is just Mandu, just biomass of lithrinids inside Mandu, and you can squint at it. It's kind of nice if I show you that. That's a way I've been thinking about how to measure change in these kind of gradual, how to measure change when you've got gradual change. So as I mentioned earlier, we're actually pretty good at detecting abrupt changes, but measuring gradual changes, not quite so good, but there's a bunch of different methods out. This is just fitting a statistical model to the data. It's a generalized additive model. It's kind of handy, I'm discovering, because you can do a bunch of things with it. You can start looking at, for example, when is change significant? when are there particular change points? for the purposes of today, it kind of doesn't matter, because the point of it's just to show that compared to when we started in 2007, there's been change, right? So in the red zones, so in the recreation zones where angling's allowed, it's kind of been flat. There's been not a lot of change, but in the green zones where the sanctuary zones where no form of fishing is allowed, our confidence intervals no longer overlap with what it used to be like. And the other thing is that the first five surveys we went out, there was distinct statistically significant differences between green and red. Now there's not. But that's, I mean, 10 years is not bad. We want to keep doing it because it's really kind of teaching us a lot about the system. 10 years is not bad, but when we started, it was 20 years after the reserve had been established and decades after people had been starting to use it. So even in these sanctuary zones in 2007, we had no real way of saying, is this some sort of natural normal state? So digging around, I think Tom mentioned this a little bit earlier. There are some studies around. This is one from the just prior to when Ningaloo was declared a marine park. So from the aiming surveys, and this is from Osprey, and this is just taking their data, restricting it to the places that we've also surveyed, restricting everything down to only the bits that are comparable, and that's what we get. So when we went in 2007, if we just compare like with like, it's kind of similar to the inside the sanctuary zones was kind of similar to what they found 20 years ago, but no idea of what happened in the interim, of course. And then in these red zones, it had already started changing. And then, of course, recently, there's very little difference between the sanctuary zones and the recreation zones for this particular group of species. So what is that? I mean, then that loops us back around to, okay, that if we've got aims that are about no change due to human use, well, we've got to determine some cause and some consequence. I probably don't have time, I don't think, to go into that today. But that's kind of another bit, another unit that comes and plugs in, where we kind of start to try and use different lines of evidence to try and assess hypotheses about cause and about consequence, to say, well, why are we getting this kind of change? But what I wanted to think about was getting onto this concept of thresholds and flipping from one state to another. So Roland just now mentioned, well, parrotfish don't tend to get fished in Australia. By and large, that's true, except we have been finding similar things with parrotfish at Ningaloo than we have with some of the other groups. exactly why, so figuring out the cause and consequence with something like parrotfish is a little bit tricky, but these, compared to what we used to find, we certainly find smaller differences or no differences in parrotfish biomass now than we used to. Was that 2 minutes? Get ready to stop.
Okay. You run out of time now.
I will. So real quickly. So thresholds. Let me talk about thresholds real quick. So this is a way of thinking about thresholds. So this is our parrotfish data against our seaweed data. And so this, Fabio showed you the model of the different interacting components. This is our field data. And our field data tends to show that when we have a lot of parrotfish, we tend not to have very much seaweed. When we don't have Gandalf sticks, when we don't have many parrotfish, Sometimes we get a lot, sometimes we don't get a lot. Seaweed, there's different reasons for that, but we've got a threshold. So in inferential statistics, we're often focused on the mean, but when we're thinking about these threshold things, we're actually interested in the other metrics. So this is exactly the same kind of statistics, except using percentiles. So this helps us think about the thresholds between parrotfish and macroalgae, and thinking about how macroalgae compete with corals. And then, of course, what we want to do is loop back with Fabio and iterate. So I like doing experiments, but we can't go and do experiments on a sufficient scale in the real world. So we want to do the experiments in the model once we get that model to behave.
Interesting the comparison with Allen's work in 87 to your work in 2007. There was still a considerable amount of fishing that was happening in 87. So your comparison to the central zone should be a comparison to fished areas.
Yeah.
So there was still a drop in fished areas.
That's right.
So the pressure was probably more on fish in the Allen survey than what it was afterwards.
That's right. So that illustrates this concept of, you know, what would be natural, as in if humans weren't there doing anything, versus what we might consider to be normal versus what we might consider to be acceptable. Yeah, good point. Illustrates it well. Die.
So do you have any thoughts about why the recreation zones and the sanctuary zones are now more or less identical?
It's a good question. It's, you know, Occam's razor, the most likely reason is angling pressure. It doesn't discount long-term cycles of other things happening, but the fact that the gap's narrowing, that's the most likely explanation.
And given the actual number of days spent on monitoring activities by the fisheries, for example, it has to drop over time.
Yeah. And, you know, and we can look at things like compliance statistics, and, you know, there's plenty of fish movement data now to look at, you know, how much fish move around boundaries, and we can look at that. That seems the most likely explanation.